Before long, we'll be where it would have taken mankind millions of years of learning to reach.
And what will Mitchell learn on getting there? Will he know what to do with his power?
That's the big agenda here, is undermining the whole idea of journalism, and that's the real thing to worry about.
The good old Ministry of Truth has another outlet.
Too often, broadcast radio insults your intelligence instead of respecting it, improving it, challenging it. But not here. Where knowledge is power, this is Powerful Radio. This is 30 minutes of information and inspiration. This is the Ministry of Truth. Hello and welcome to the Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stepinchuk. In this episode, we'll feature the second part of a two-part presentation I gave, entitled Corporate Media Control and Media Reform Struggles. But first, a commentary from the website Black Agenda Report.
The corporate news media greeted new census data detailing the drastic and general decline of black populations in center cities as if the phenomenon were somehow a vindication of the American dream, a cause for celebration. The dramatic increase in the movement of African Americans back to the South, which actually began decades ago, is held up as proof positive that America's racial conflicts will soon be a thing of the past. Newsrooms seem filled with jubilation that the nation's cities will soon be liberated from two generations of concentrated black presence. Underlying the upbeat news coverage is the assumption that a diffusion of blacks is, by definition, a good thing for the nation as a whole and for black people themselves. It also assumes, against all relevant evidence, that this mass movement of black people from New York City, Chicago, Philadelphia, Los Angeles, Detroit, Oakland, and so many other cities is totally voluntary, that economic pushout has played no major role in emptying the cities of blacks and sending hundreds of thousands down to Dixie. It is an absurd assumption by journalists whose elation at the black exodus compels them to ignore gentrification as one of the main factors. People who are priced out of the cities by gentrification cannot be considered voluntary migrants. Gentrification has become an overarching fact of black urban existence, making life less tenable every day, especially in New York. It is no wonder that 17% of blacks that relocated to the South in the past decade were New Yorkers, far more than from any other state. When gentrification places the monthly rent hopelessly out of reach, there is no choice but to leave. And why not South, where it's cheaper and there are so many people who look like you, some of whom are related? Those who would characterize the black southward movement as overwhelmingly voluntary and non-economic speculate that folks are going south to be near family. But family has always been there. Why the big rush to join them now? There is literally no statistical basis in U.S. Census data to conclude that the urge to strengthen family ties is an important factor in reverse black migration. But white corporate media and the types of black folks that work for it have no problem substituting their own favorite scenarios for real data and real facts. Black movement from inner cities to the suburbs is also intertwined with gentrification. It is not only the poor who are pushed out, but also better-off families and singles for whom city life is no longer viable. But all suburbs are not alike. Study after study shows that blacks more often wind up just outside the borders of the central city in older suburbs, many of which have the characteristics of inner-city ghettos without the conveniences and urban amenities. Such suburbs hug the edges of Washington, Chicago, and Detroit. Other suburbs may appear to be racially integrated today, but that is only a snapshot in time. These places will be much blacker or browner tomorrow because of white flight, the root source of segregation in America. Whites are also in flight from the truth that the deeply racial dynamic of gentrification is forcing many black folks to cheaper suburbs and the lower-cost South, including many blacks that claim the move is strictly voluntary. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
You're listening to The Ministry of Truth. I'm Mitchell Stripinchuk. We now feature the second part of a two-part presentation I gave, entitled Corporate Media Control and Media Reform Struggles. The presentation, given at Third Unitarian Church in Chicago on Sunday, January 16, 2011, outlined the struggles for a democratic media system in the United States, extending all the way back to the founding of the United States. The first part of the presentation discussed the struggle over time on a medium-by-medium basis, including print and newspapers, the telegraph, the telephone, movies, radio, and television. But we begin the second part of the presentation discussing a new trend beginning in the 1980s, consolidation across all media. There was media concentration before the 1980s, but for the most part that was concentration that was restricted to a small number of players within a given media industry. In the 1980s, companies started to build conglomerates across media industries, so that it wasn't just a TV producer, or a film studio, or a newspaper publisher. It was a TV producer, and a film studio, and a newspaper publisher, and much more besides. The raison d'être was, as usually is, profit. More profit can be generated by producing content once, and then redistributing it along all of one's channels. So then a race was underway to consolidate media across industries, aided by zealots in government subscribing to supposed free market principles, but instead aiding and abetting the formation of the greatest media monopolies heretofore seen. The greatest chronicler of this new consolidation trend was Ben Bagdikian, former editor at the Washington Post and dean emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. In 1983, Bagdikian published a book called The Media Monopoly, which noted that there were just 50 companies which commanded the lion's share of media in the United States, and that the trend was to consolidate further, perhaps to as few as 6 media companies. The book was republished in updated editions 7 times in the next 2 decades to chronicle the continuing changes in the American media landscape. By the time the 7th edition came out in 2004, Bagdikian wound up being wrong in one respect. It didn't get down to as few as 6 media companies. In that book, he listed just 5. Bagdikian and many others also chronicled the negative consequences of such concentration. Increased commercialism, less journalism, less independence from the bottom line, more conflicts of interest, fewer diverse perspectives, and even life or death situations, as was the case in the city of Minot, North Dakota, which in 2002 saw a chemical leak from a train derailment which caused hundreds to be hospitalized. And when local police tried to get on the radio to alert the public, they found that 6 of the 7 Minot radio stations were being broadcast from a single clear channel office in Minot, which was unstaffed at the time of the leak. The response to this trend of media concentration crystallized arguably the most dynamic, successful, and inspiring media reform effort in a generation, the Media Ownership Uprising of 2003. The trend toward greater media concentration was critically enabled at the federal government, spurred to greater heights or depths through the 1996 Telecommunications Act and the FCC of George W. Bush, headed for 4 years by market zealot Michael Powell, son of former Secretary of State Colin Powell. The Telecom Act required the FCC to review its media ownership rules every 4 years, and in 2002, the FCC, to little fanfare, announced that it would likely amend a number of critical media ownership rules in part of its effort to deregulate the media, which would have made the trend of consolidation seen thus far look tame by comparison. And with key pro-big media Republicans and key points in the government, the major media virtually mute so that they could cash in big, and a considerable history of media reformers' hopes dashed from one medium to the next, the fix looked to be in. It was in this fight where I first cut my teeth on media reform struggles. But what happened wasn't just me and didn't happen overnight. It was the efforts of scholars and activists well before I joined the fray, going back decades. But I arrived when the moment, this fight found a moment to crystallize. Small groups throughout the country, including here in Chicago, started to organize. 5 of us in Chicago met a week before the FCC announced its media ownership rule revisions. This coincided with the group of the formation of the group here in Chicago. I'm a part of Chicago Media Action, and efforts like helping to organize an unofficial hearing at Northwestern University, sending a team to Richmond, Virginia, to the only public FCC official public FCC hearing on the matter, getting on Chicago's KNTV and in community newspapers to discuss the issue, and using the internet, without which the effort to stop this may never have happened at all. After months of nonstop outreach and activism, the FCC, nevertheless, to little surprise, voted 3-2 on June 2, 2003 to its proposed rule changes. But the public outcry was palpable, breaking FCC public comment records by orders of magnitude, as the issue ranked as the second most popular news issue of 2003, trailing only the launch of the war in Iraq. And the corporate media were caught flat-footed, facing losing votes in Congress, and on September 3, 2003, an emergency court order stayed that FCC decision, just one day before the rules were slated to go into effect. That court order remained in effect for 7 years, and it's no exaggeration to say that it prevented a bad media system from becoming far worse. The Tribune Company, which gambled its future on those media ownership rule changes, whined on its editorial pages over the outcome. But that stay indirectly resulted in a Tribune shareholder revolt, forcing a change of ownership, leading to local billionaire Sam Zell taking charge and later running the company into bankruptcy, a situation the company still finds itself mired in today. The whole episode, nevertheless, was inspiring and revealing. Activism works, even on something as seemingly abstruse as media policy, where seemingly few outside of those who stand to profit from such policies seem to understand or care about such policies. The key to victory has been, ironically enough, the very thing that makes the media unique on this issue. They're the only ones who command the ability to debate their own politics. As a result, those politics are immensely corrupt, so bringing wider awareness to them by any and every means at your disposal turns out to be an effective tactic. The lessons learned by media reform activists in 2003 came into play again in 2006 during what's called the net neutrality wars over the internet. That struggle came in the wake of a number of policy decisions involving the internet, including what some scholars deem to be a key 1990 invitation-only gathering of government and tech firms at Harvard University, which apparently resulted in the government privatizing part of its internet backbone. The Michael Powell-led FCC took another step in 2002 by reclassifying the internet in such a way that weakened common carriage provisions of internet content. And when a court challenge to undo that classification failed at the Supreme Court in 2005, corporate ISPs salivated at the chance to pass legislation in their favor to establish a two-tiered internet, as it was called. That legislation came in 2006, entitled the COPE Act, and not only would have changed the internet as we knew it, it also would have irreparably affected public access television through the establishment of a single national cable franchise, which would have bled funding. The bill sailed through the House, aided to no small extent by Illinois' own Bobby Rush, the bill's first Democratic co-sponsor. Nevertheless, awareness of what was going on started to widen, mostly using the internet, and this newfangled technology called blogs. Plus, protests gained more attention, including a national series of protests in May 2006, which began in Chicago, called the National Day of Outrage. The House passed the COPE Act, but when it got to the Senate, internet freedom advocates with the wind at their backs were able to egg some senators on to ask critical questions about the COPE Act, which led to a famous rambling response by the Senate's lead shepherd on telecom policy, Alaska Senator Ted Stevens, in which he embarrassingly and famously called the internet a series of tubes. Stevens got the COPE Act out of committee in the Senate, yet the PR fiasco from his remarks made the legislation too volatile to bring up to a full Senate vote, and the COPE Act died through inaction in the end. It's key to remember that the same recipe for victory with the COPE Act in this internet fight as followed what happened in 2003 with the media ownership rule fight. Build public awareness to build public involvement when public awareness and involvement are lacking, and let the chips fall where they may. In 2006, then-Senator Barack Obama noted his support for network neutrality on his campaign trail for the White House. In 2009, President Obama appointed former telco executive Julius Genachowski chair of the FCC and tasked with approving a net neutrality bill. Last month, that actually happened. On December 21st, 2010, the FCC did implement a net neutrality bill, but one which has been roundly criticized as being too weak and full of loopholes. The struggle on this will continue to improve that bill, as it always does. So after all of this, what are some of the big picture points that can be raised? Let me mention three brief lessons. Lesson one, American media don't just fall from the sky. They're the result of a number of factors, and most critically, the policies that help to shape the media. While major media would like you to believe that the media spring from natural processes, there's nothing natural about them. They're often very bitterly fought. Lesson two, people can affect those policies, and I'm not referring to high-paid, well-connected lobbyists. Everyday normal people can affect those policies. Indeed, a number of defeats that we had seen in points of the media reform struggles in American history were often by narrow margins, and if things had gone slightly differently, those losses could have been wins. On the other hand, a number of reform wins that we can claim, especially in recent years, came when those efforts had no right to do so, but because people were willing to do the work in organizing, outreach, smart planning, and in a word, getting involved. The more people get involved in shaping those media, the better our chances for success. And lesson number three, we have to work to change institutions that affect media but are not media. We seem to be stuck between two obsolete institutional frameworks that have affected media and much else for centuries. A single government, the state, in the political sphere, and a single market spawning corporations in the economic sphere. Much of the struggle for a better media have been struggling against one, sometimes both, of these institutional spheres. Much of the struggle will mean struggling for fighting in that. And in order to ensure a better media, and much else besides, those institutions, I think, should be changed, at the very least, rethought. There's been a rich tradition of thinking on this front, and a great many new theoretical developments, much of which has been maligned as heretical, understandably by those with power. But I think that a better media requires better political and economic institutions. What those might look like, how the media would look and operate on that front, and how such institutions can be achieved fall outside the scope of this presentation. But we do ourselves no favor to ignore the question forever. Indeed, by tackling it, we may well be on our way to far greater successes tackling corporate media control and winning in media reform. Thank you very much. I look forward to your questions and comments. Laurel, go ahead, field questions, please.
Okay, I'm just amazed at the amount of information we just heard in a short time, and trying to process. And I have to make a comment that since I've known Mitchell, he has been, you know, so immersed in all these struggles. I remember last year when you were fighting those changes that made us all have to put those ugly boxes on top of our TV.
The digital television fight.
Yes, yep. Digital television. And since I don't see any hands yet, let me ask you, what the heck are those, what's that all about? What are those little boxes, and why do they complicate my life so much?
What Laurel's referring to is the conversion that took place over the last 5+ years, but was finalized on June 12, 2009, of digital trend television. The idea that previously television had been broadcast by analog waves through the airwaves on the electromagnetic spectrum. But it was discovered that broadcast, the signal quality as well as signal quantity could be improved by turning that to digital, basically changing that analog wave into a series of ones and zeros to be broadcast through the air. Problem is that for many people who don't have cable or satellite service, and that, estimates of that were about maybe 20% of all Americans, their only option was to basically convert along with that. And the government provided efforts, including funding about a $2 billion program for vouchers to help to provide, pay for converter boxes. There are a few problems with that, not the least of which is that that program ended in the black. About half the money that was allotted for that program wound up getting unspent. People didn't claim the boxes that the vouchers that they could have used to help to pay for those. So that leads me to think that actually a lot of people are still without television. Now, a lot of people, when you say, okay, big deal, TV is full of crap, why should I care? Well, for a lot of people who don't have a whole lot in the way of media resources, a lot of TV was basically one of the few outlets that they could reliably have. The problem now with that is that we've all changed, and there's not really much in the way of institutional impetus to try to change back. Nonetheless, I think this is part of parcel of the overall movements for general equality, to make sure that the people who need media can get media. And it's not just with television, but with the entirety, especially regarding the digital divide, where people who, maybe 40% of Americans, can't afford internet access on a regular basis. And so this is probably part of that struggle to help to ensure greater equality regarding media generally. And this digital television fight has been part and parcel of that.
Thank you.
Okay, we have, let me see, this gentleman, and then they're here. Okay, go ahead.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'm a longtime banker, Mr. Chicago. I saw you at the Teamsters.
Yes.
And I'm very interested in the media. I distribute, and I write letters to the editor for News and Letters,
mm-hmm.
and I also have People's Tribune here.
Right.
Mainly because on page 7, it has a thing on Martin Luther King and labor and peace activists, so I thought it would be apropos for our service. And but how do you get involved? I like to do some writing. I talk to the People's Tribune. I may write for them, but News and Letters let me write letters, but not articles. I'm a friend of theirs. So how do you get involved to if you want to do writing and as a individual?
How do you get involved in issues related to media policy? Yeah, is the question.
Like I have friends in the media too, but
right.
I'm saying how do I if I want to do some writing, say for a newspaper, other than these that I'm associated with.
So you wanted to write to media?
No. Write articles for them as an individual.
Okay.
Or support them. I'll talk to you later.
Okay. Okay. The quick answer for that could be I could plug you into various journalists on that. But one problem with this has been that that is a field that is increasingly shrinking. I mean, I've been to journalist conferences where the future of journalism in the United States is regarded as something of a joke. Especially since newspapers have been shrinking. Journalism as an institution has been under unremitting attack for the last 30 years. Newspapers are still around, but are increasingly seen as perhaps on the way out. And it's a shame because of a lot of media resources, a lot of original content come from commercial newspapers still.
I think we should start a newspaper in Chicago.
That would be a great idea. There have been attempts to do that repeatedly. There are still a lot of community newspapers, like the Chicago Journal, the Chicago Reporter, the Chicago Reader, Corporate Tribune, but nevertheless. But yeah, there are efforts on this front. So see me after class. We can talk about it more.
Okay, over here.
In the last comment you made before this one, you were talking about what is often referred to as...
I just like it. I have nothing to do with it.
As convergence, and I think it goes beyond media because not only telephone and television and fax and so on are all using the internet as the actual pathway, and any number of magazines and newspapers have stopped printing.
Mm-hmm.
And stop broadcasting on radio and gone to use the internet, or even when it's on radio, transmitting the same content over the internet. What happens when those five corporations capture all of that and we have no mechanism for communicating? And how does that relate to what the attacks on the internet?
You're quite right regarding what's going on there, regarding convergence. This is the trend, and has been. We've seen it accelerate, especially with television, but it's bound to accelerate more probably in the coming decade. All of media are being digitized. We've already seen it with television. Radio is something of a question mark because that actually may not get digitized because they may find that it's not efficient to do so. Long story about that. But also a lot of what would typically be print media, U.S. News and World Report, the Christian Science Monitor, these are publications that no longer print in any printed form. They're only online. And a lot of people use resources of this online. So yeah, that's where I think the net neutrality fight was so critical there, to make sure that the barriers to entry, the costs wouldn't just jump up to a level that would be too onerous for most people to be able to afford. I can pay for, and I do, $130 a year to an internet service provider to maintain my website. And not only the website, but also technical stuff, because I work as a software developer for a living, for access of content and being able to distribute that. And anyone who's on the internet, including around the world, can access that content. Problem, though, is that, yeah, the internet service providers, the Comcasts, the AT&Ts, the Verizons, maybe a handful of other companies, would like to pay to play, basically. Not only would you have to pay for access as you currently do now, but raise it so that if you wanted to get preferential treatment, there would be artificial barriers that would be imposed, and the cost would just jump up too high. If you want to buy a television ad in Chicago, you'd have to pay upwards of $70,000 to an ad. I'm sorry, I don't have $70,000 in the cushions of my couch.
I can't afford that. Most people reasonably can't. Yet, unfortunately, that's the cost of barrier to entry on television, at least for even buying a single 30-second ad. Never mind, the internet is far more affordable to be able to do that. $70,000, you could probably, you know, salary of three people and a lot of content, who knows. But that's the issue there, and that's where the struggle regarding the internet, I think, is so crucial, and why I'm heartened to see that there have been developments on that front. There need to be more. We saw a fairly bad bill that was approved by the FCC. There's a good chance that actually may get overturned in court. And whether or not some kind of replacement bill may help to fill that void, we don't know. But the fact is that that happened to no small extent because people got involved and stayed involved. And that's going to be the key to winning on this, to make sure that, you know, not only the internet, but all media besides remain free and open and are expanded for possibilities of democratic discourse.
Okay, Carla, I saw you next, and then Joanna.
A couple of things. Number one, did they know when they passed this stupid thing that those boxes would be as horrific as they are? I mean, we finally had to go to basic cable because to get the stations, if you take Channel 7, if you put your antenna here and turn it on its side, and to get Channel 2, you might do this and put it up in the air. I mean, it's almost impossible to get the... And if you stand close to it, it'll come in. And if you move away, then you're not got it anymore. So did they know that was going to happen? I mean, we've had to go to basic because it's impossible to get the stations on this.
I've heard a lot of complaints regarding this. In fact, actually, the Reader article, it looked to the March 20th, 2009 article about the Reader. This goes into much detail. They actually interviewed me about the article, front page story. It wouldn't surprise me to hear like technical complaints that were raised regarding the quality or lack thereof, especially given the geographic basis about this. The problem, though, is that it wasn't really engineers who were calling the shots on this. It was lobbyists and financiers at the top. And a big reason why this wound up getting pushed through. The fiasco of what occurred in early 2009 was a big reason why the deadline, which was actually originally for February 17, 2009, got delayed 4 months. Because they were actually, they blew me away with what happened. The program for funding digital converter boxes actually ran out of money. And they actually had to start what I never thought would actually happen, a waiting list, grew to about 4 million names. They wound up clearing it out, and they wound up paying a lot of money, and that actually helped a lot of people. But for a still number of people who still remain not to be helped, we don't know. I've not seen any surveys or studies about this. The only analysis we have is that the government announced that the program actually had an excess of funds.
I think that probably a lot of people just went to...
That's true. And in fact, you see, like, you know, Comcast and DirecTV offering, like, super cheap introductory rates for people to afford to be able to, you know, get on cable. Because they knew that it's like, hey, we got more customers. And then, you know, jack up the prices later after, like, a year or so. But yeah, no, people who were slated to cash in big were not asleep at the switch on this. Now, I wouldn't necessarily point to some kind of necessarily conspiracy. You're finding different people who are pushing for various things and competing for, jockeying for position on this front. And a lot of them have things to benefit. But you may also see convergence on this front. Comcast right now could well buy out NBC Universal. I mean, that's a very scary proposition regarding media. So now the cable provider is now a serious provider in movies, broadcast, music, a couple of other industries besides, in addition to cable and internet access.
Okay, Joanna.
Yeah, and I see a lot of the organizations and activists and et cetera that I used to rely on getting information via their websites going on to Facebook, and it seems like they let their website sit, and everything that they need people to know or want to broadcast out there, they put on their Facebook page. And I'm wondering what you think about that medium, as both as far as to what extent, you know, there's a potential for them to start controlling content, and would they do so? And also whether it's any substitute for some of the other avenues that we used to use to talk to each other and get out the truth, because I feel like it's kind of a... It's kind of short attention span media.
So the question about Facebook, does is Facebook hampering or a good thing or a bad thing regarding some of these other media trends? Facebook is barely 6 years old. It has grown with astonishing rapidity. It's basically was a guy, you know, if you've seen the movie The Social Network, you know the story. Nerd at Harvard comes up with an idea for a website, and lo and behold, it actually becomes, you know, immensely popular, the most popular website on the entire web, in fact. I can see both good and bad coming from it. Good in the sense that now a lot of people use it as an avenue for social networking of ideas, so ideas or whatevers can travel with even greater speed than before, and I count that as a good thing. Bad thing for two reasons. One is, as the media and internet ecosystem is concerned, that's a lot of eggs to put in one basket. Yeah. And if Facebook goes down, or if something happens regarding Facebook, it encounters some kind of a super aggressive corporate takeover scheme. It may who knows what may happen. Plus, also the fact that it's a commercial entity. I mean, they're there to make money, admittedly. So that there's that pressure there that they have to try to fight and attend to. There have been attempts. They're still kind of like in the very early stages. To try to provide grassroots equivalents of Facebook. Some of these have gotten some attention. A lot of them are still very nascent, nowhere near the scale of Facebook, but that might be a beneficial hope. The hope is that Facebook remains enough of an open, and I think, remember also regarding social media, trends can change fast, both in the up and in the down, so that, well, I mean, not only laugh at Facebook, MySpace.
Yeah.
I mean, MySpace is laying off half their staff, and there's talk that News Corporation, Fox, Rupert Murdoch, which paid $580 million to buy the website in 2005, may well sell it off because nobody goes there anymore. In fact, you can actually now access MySpace through Facebook. It's gotten that bad.
That was the second part of a two-part presentation I gave entitled Corporate Media Control and Media Reform Struggles, recorded on January 16, 2011. Listen to all past episodes of The Ministry of Truth online at www.szcz.org. That concludes this episode of The Ministry of Truth. Special thanks to Mario and the staff of WHPK Radio in Chicago. Thank you for listening.